This episode is brought to you by Gin & Co., author website design specialists. If you want a beautiful and functional website to promote your books and brand, reach out to Gin today. His work includes tailored, expertly designed professional author websites. I finally have a website I'm proud to share. And we've got a special offer for Words and Nerds listeners. Reach out today and get a free domain name and website hosting for the first year. You can get their website essentials package, includes domain name, website hosting, backup and security, free for the first year with any website purchase. This is valued at $330 a year. Choose a website designed to bring your author brand to life. You can find more details about this special offer at ginand.co/wordsandnerds. Welcome to the 2024 series of the Words and Nerds podcast. I'm Danny B, author, publisher, and your podcast host. With over 1 million plays, thanks to you, listeners, readers, writers, creatives, teachers, librarians, and book lovers, thank you for coming along for the journey where we bring you relaxed and real conversations about writing and creativity. If you love an episode, you can leave a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow the podcast on Instagram or Facebook at Danny V Words and Nerds Podcast. Or you can check out my brand new website designed by Gin & Co. at dannyv.com.au. Welcome to the Words and Nerds Podcast, where we bring literary goodness straight to your ears. Today, I welcome Maura Pilo. She is an author, playwright, and filmmaker. She also enjoys writing creative nonfiction for children. Some of her books include What Will You Make Today?, The Trouble in Toontown, and the book we'll be talking about today, Alphabetta, Better Ways to Be from A to Z. It presents a fun, relatable scenarios that encourage children to explore positive values. Welcome to the podcast. More.
Hey Danny, great to be here. Thanks for the opportunity to chat about my latest book.
I love talking about books, as I'm sure you well know.
I do. I've heard.
So for Alphabetta, hit us with an elevator pitch.
Oh, Alphabetta. Okay, here we go. Alphabetta is a creative nonfiction book that presents 26 values and virtues and positive character traits. From A to Z is the basis for making good choices and for character building. So it's based loosely, but not literally, on Aristotle's virtue ethics. That's a practical guide that gives meaning to values and virtues only in action. You know, so for Aristotle, a kind person is someone who performs kind acts. You become courageous by performing courageous acts. It doesn't otherwise make sense to say you're kind or courageous unless those actions back you up. And for Aristotle, virtues and values and living that good life is habitual. So this is a book that helps kids to explore these values and virtues to become the kind of people they'd like to be. And I'd like to think it's a great resource for the classroom, for home, and for life.
I love how we've just gone straight to Aristotle as an influence for this picture book, which I love. I love it when bigger things, make their way into picture books, because I think that's really important. And even if they don't understand it in the beginning, I mean, there's so much you can talk about. And not only is there an Aristotle influence, you've also got, you know, all these ethics in it as well, because I know that's an important part of, you know, what you've studied and what you've done as well. So talk me through, you talked to me a little bit about the Aristotle influence, and then how does that work with ethics for children?
Aristotle, I mean, a lot of people might think, what's some old guy who lived 2,500 years ago? I mean, like, why do we care? And what could he possibly have to say that's relevant? I think I gravitated towards philosophy because I've always been a deep thinker. I've always been drawn to big ideas. And those questions, you know, kind of tossed about by the ancient Greeks, some of whom devoted their lives to exploring those issues, are still relevant today. So they're all questions about the human condition. I think ethics gets a bad rap in a lot of ways. I think a lot of people don't know what it is when they hear virtues, even the word virtue. I was raised in a very strong Catholic family. I immediately think of the church. So for a lot of people, it has that like religious connotation and they distance themselves a bit from it. A lot of people think ethics is like a moral authority telling you what to do. You know, it just seems a little bit authoritative. You know, other people just don't quite know what it means. So part of the aim of this book is to try to make philosophy a little bit more accessible, because ethics for some philosophers is many theories of ethics. I could do a TED talk on ethical theory, you know, from ancient Greece to today. But there's just different principles that underlie it. And many people think, right or wrong, that ethics helps you work out what to do. And that's true. It does. If you have a dilemma, it can help you reason through it. But for me, it's not so much the focus on what's the right thing to do. Ethics isn't about discovering what's the right course of action, because sometimes there is no right course of action. Sometimes all you can do is ask the questions. But for me, and this is based loosely on Aristotle, which is why I always gravitated to him. For me, ethics is more about kind of developing a sensibility and a sensitivity, like keeping, I guess, values and principles in the back of your mind to find your way through the world and go, okay, it's not just me. You know, there's some things I want to do, but it's not all about me. It's about me as an individual and myself, me within a family, me with friends, me in a community, me as a global citizen. And ethics gives you that big picture and that broad perspective. So it all starts with character building. It's like the moral outlook where you say, okay, what kind of person do you want to be? You know, do you want to be someone who thinks of others? Do you want to be someone who's kind and considerate? Do you want to be someone who's brave? For Aristotle, virtue was always trying to find the mean, not the mathematical mean, like straight in the middle, everyone do the same thing, but the right course of action, the moderate course for each person in that particular situation, given who they are, how they're wired, what the context is. So for example, off the top of my head, courage would be a virtue. But if you went too far to one extreme and you were craven and cowardly and you just couldn't even do anything, you know, for fear, that would be an excess, you know, that's more of a vice. And likewise, if you go to the other extreme and you have no fear whatsoever, like almost irresponsibly no fear, it would be also considered a vice in Aristotelian terms. You'd be reckless. So the virtue is finding somewhere in the middle, not mathematically, not literally, but striving to live between excesses, controlling your will and your appetite, trying to be practical about what you can do in this life and how you can live a good life, which is living a life in balance based on all of these values and virtues that you have to moderate. The book doesn't go into this level of detail, God help me, like, you know, no five-year-old is going to cope with that, or even their parents necessarily. But I guess part of my aim is trying to offer some clarity around ethics, trying to get away from that. Even when I hear morality, I go, ew, it's just kind of like, it's not really a good term. So trying to make ethics more explicit, make it more overt, remove some of the misunderstanding about it and position it as a practical tool. Because, I mean, ethics, when I first studied philosophy as an undergrad, it was by default because my dad wanted me to do something practical like economics or learn Russian. And this was the 80s, so I'm kind of aging myself here by telling you when I went to uni. And I just didn't have the brain for that. And I ended up with philosophy. And it's like, wow, I'm home. In this world of ideas, this all makes sense. Everything crystallizes. And when I went on for a master's and went on for a PhD, then people started to think I was just slightly delusional and had no grasp on reality. Because they're thinking, why on earth are you studying something so ethereal and esoteric? Like, what the hell are you going to do that? You know, with that in your life, you know, there's no jobs for philosophers. But I always argued that philosophy trains you more than any discipline to really be a good thinker.
I was going to say that there's always jobs for deep thinking.
They're not billed as such. But I think in any job you have, in any career, you need to be able to think critically, think analytically, use logic, be a good negotiator, good moderator, be good at argumentation, the art of rhetoric, you know, to try to get your point across, especially in a digital age. When our kids were in school, they're in their 20s now, and they weren't natural students at all. The bright kids, the great all-rounders, sporty, funny, great personalities, but they were at a very academic school and it was not a good fit. And I remember they'd come home and I just felt for them because they were expected to learn and to memorize a lot of very detailed, very specific, I'd call them factoids, that might sound interesting and they would broaden your outlook and your experience in the world. But I don't think arguably that you would use them in your adult life unless you chose a certain path. And I kept thinking, why can't they teach you just to think well?
Yeah, I think critical thinking is so important, even in life, you know, not just at school. And I think exactly that way, because we all carry a little mini computer in our pocket or in our handbag. And so we don't need to remember facts unless you want to be great at trivia. That's the only reason why I think you need to know dates. I think it's much more important to do that critical thinking, particularly with all the misinformation that we get from our internet, our wonderful internet that doesn't always give us truthful, unbiased information. So particularly me with little kids who are starting to research for assignments, etc. You know, it's like, well, have you checked it? Are you thinking critically about it? Where did you get this information from? Because I think critical thinking has never been more important than now.
Exactly. And it doesn't give correct information, as you said, but I think the somewhat scary fact is a lot of people, even reasonably well-educated people, like I bump into a lot of people in a lot of industries just for various things that we do, you know, like writing's a big part, but a small part of my life. I'm always amazed at the people that kind of take everything as, you know, just the gospel by virtue of reading it in a publication that seems legitimate. And I'm not talking about like really obscure publications that are like single issue driven and highly political. I'm talking about semi-reputable ones. So I think the way most people go through life is they say, I have a worldview. I don't know how I formed it, I just do.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to go through life looking at the different things I can find and read and learn to support that view.
Exactly.
If you challenge that view, no, all hell will rain down on you, because then that makes me think I'm wrong. And then I feel very unsettled about this world that I've constructed for myself. I've always gone about it the opposite. And this comes from Socrates, not to just casually throw in another
name drop Socrates.
Why not? Name dropper. But his whole thing, you know, let's say his shtick, you know, but not that they would call it that, is the only thing that he knew was that he knew nothing. So he came from a position where, you know, the people in life that are dangerous are the ones who think they know a lot or are convinced they know a lot. So I've gone through life in a similar way. I assume everything is kind of open slather. I don't take anything necessarily at face value. I think, okay, well, that makes sense, but I'm going to do my own digging. I'm going to do my own investigating. I'm going to do my own reading and challenging, and that doesn't stack, and that seems contradictory, and that's a bit inconsistent. And I wish schools, I'm not slamming schools by any means. My God, I could never be a teacher for many, many, many reasons. And I know the curriculum authorities do the best they can to jam-pack what they perceive is needed for the 21st century. I just happen to have a disagreement about what those things are. So I would, you know, if I had a school, God help us all, I would have a different approach to teaching. You know, I wouldn't mainstream.
Well, that was the joy of English when I taught English for 17 years. And the joy of English was you could have discussions and you could have deep thinking, because when you read a novel, you know, there isn't always one answer or one perspective, and it's all contextual as well. So that was really interesting. I don't think I could have taught history, where it's a lot of facts and a lot of dates, because like I said, you just Google them when you need them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But well, everyone has a different world wired differently, and I guess you get the info you need to get the way you need to get it.
So I'm terrible at trivia. Like, I've no idea about trivia, because I just never memorize facts. I just don't see the point.
I went to a trivia comp not too long ago, and I don't go to a lot. I usually do quite well, because I learned early on you just need a smattering of people, and my friendship group is a smattering. There's a lot of expats, different countries.
Sports person, because I'm no good with sport.
The key, and this is where we failed miserably a few weeks ago, is there was really no one under 40 at our table. There was probably, to be honest, no one under 50.
You needed a millennial in there, younger, or a Gen X in there.
I should have brought one.
Tell you about all the Taylor Swift stuff.
All the songs, obscure references, lingo. And I think
that's funny.
Yeah,
all right. Well, next time you've got it. Absolutely. Now, you said something, circling back a little bit, about ethics, you know, from Aristotle till today. What are the major things that have changed in ethics from going back into, you know, Greek history to now?
I don't know that a lot has changed. I mean, there's a lot of different theories. There's different schools of thought. You know, there are theories of ethics that are called consequentialist theory. So they're outcome based. And they think, you know, the good, you know, to perform the act, you know, in question is the best course of action produces the best outcome for the best number of people. So there are like many utilitarian views like that. And there's some merit to those arguments on a policy level. But I don't quite buy into that philosophy wholeheartedly for a lot of reasons. There are ethical theories that are more rule and principle based. There was someone named Immanuel Kant, you know, a few hundred years ago, who basically said we should act in a way that we could will that everyone else would act in the same way. It's a categorical imperative. It's almost like a modified version of the golden rule. Just having, that's like grossly oversimplifying, but I don't want all these like well-trained, well-known philosophers, if they happen to listen to your podcast, pointing out that that's not quite right with Immanuel Kant's theory, because it's very detailed. And these people wrote like thousands of pages on this. It's like they dedicated their life to it. But I guess his point is you need to universalize your actions. And if you can do that, then there's some merit to it. If you can't, you know, you'd have to go, oh, is that the case? There's someone named John Rawls, who's a very well-known contemporary philosopher. His philosophy was that we should act behind a veil of ignorance. So say as a thought experiment, we're all forming this society. We're going to develop rules for this society. So let's go off. But the catch is we don't know where we're going to end up in that society. So we could end up, you know, in a country where every day we are fighting for our survival. We could end up in a harborfront mansion. We could end up a lot of places in between. What rules are we going to develop? Not knowing what our standing is in society, because our standing really doesn't have much to do with merit when you think about it. I mean, it sometimes does. So there's lots of different theories. And then there's a move back to virtue ethics, back to Aristotle. He's the one philosopher. And the reason I subscribe to his view, where I just intuitively grasped it, was unlike these others that have like principles and rules and they're somewhat prescriptive and universal maxims and this and that, consequences tally up the score. His ethics is character-based. So it's all agent-focused. It's all about the person and it's very practical. So Aristotle thought what distinguished us from other living creatures and beings, animals, plant life, is we have practical reason. So we can go through life and we can have an aim in life, you know, as conscious beings. We can work towards that aim and we can use that reason to try to decide what the mean is, you know, that moderate path forward between vices. So sometimes things come full circle, way over the head of kids. I think way over the head, but when I think about it, not really. And I did a radio interview the other day and they had some philosophers on who go about bringing ethics into schools and they're doing great work, you know, so like hats off to them. But one of them mentioned, and I had read this elsewhere recently, that people are like equating philosophy, they're making philosophy as a verb. So there isn't philosophy for kids, but it's kids doing philosophy. And the doing is essentially critical thinking. So my worry is that people, I'm glad they're talking about it and that it's in schools and it's such a useful discipline. But there's going to be this collective view that whenever we're just like dissecting issues and talking about them, chatting, that we're doing philosophy. And philosophy is a lot more than that. And, you know, it have to be like a very simple summary of the teachings of some of the key thinkers throughout time, how they're different, but the commonality that links them together on this like path, you know, this, you know, inquiry for life and the meaning of life and purpose. I mean, Aristotle, in a way, even though he's not billed as such, is the father of positive psychology. When you think of his virtue ethics, it's all about the good life. For Aristotle, the good life was eudaimonia, which translates from the Greek as some people say happiness, because there's no exact word, but a better word would be flourishing or thriving.
Mm-hmm. And they sound like good words. I want those words in my life.
Yeah, but I mean, everyone does when you look online anywhere now in socials, blogs, talk to friends. Everyone's trying to work out like, oh, you know, I need a sea change. I'm leaving my job. It's just not making me happy. Where do I fit in all of this? Why am I here? Why am I doing this when I'm driving no joy? Like every day people are going through. Like I had my first existential crisis when I was 8, I think. I was just one of those kids where I'm like, why am I here? This isn't making sense to me. I want to do bigger and better things. I grew up in a strict environment where, you know, kids were just expected to do what they were told. And when you're older, you can follow your own path. But depending on how your brain is wired, that might, I guess, be hard to accept. That's a long time to wait.
Yeah.
To do your own thing.
Absolutely. Now, you are a playwright, a filmmaker, an author. How do you think creativity feeds other types of creativity?
I think they're all linked. I think it's just having an openness, a willingness to be vulnerable. You know, I mean, I don't even know why I write. Someone asked me the other day in the context of something. And, you know, the trite thing to say would be like to make sense of the world, you know, which is true. And even though it seems to be the thing that a lot of people say, and there's nothing wrong with that. I think for me, when I look back, my upbringing, I had an Irish heritage, father, Italian mother. And on both sides of the family, even though there's lots of strengths, lots of love and joy and fun things, when it came to emotions, just actually navigating life and getting, you know, deep down into those nitty gritty things, we weren't that good at that. Now, this could be a product of the time, but you just didn't talk about stuff, you know? So even when my father died, you know, of course, it was sad. Of course, we were all lost a bit of ourselves. But, you know, you didn't convene as a family. You didn't talk about it. You were just expected to get on with life. So I think if you grow up in an environment where, you know, you have emotion, but you probably aren't quite sure how to access it, or it's not drawn out of you in any one way. You need some sort of outlook or expression for that. And for me, that was always creative expression. My mother was an artist and an opera singer, so there was always like that creative vibe happening in our house. So for me, they just feed off each other. I couldn't, there's nothing wrong with it, but for me and just where I'm coming from, I wouldn't be creatively satisfied if I just wrote books. I feel like if I'm putting my heart and soul into the words, I want to try to expand the reach of the work if people are engaging with it, not for its own sake, not because I did a lot of work and put in a lot of hours, but I tend to write on issues that relate to the heart of the human condition. And when people engage strongly with the work, it makes me want to look at other avenues for creative expression. That came about with Fragments as a play. And I had funding and I had a lot of support and it was a great experience. But once you put a play on, even though it's sold out at every show, it's done. You know, that's it. And then where do you go? So I wanted to try to bring it out in different formats because I know from our own kids, not everyone engages with theater. Not everyone engages with text or reading a book. Some kids engage better with film. You know, so it's not assuming there's any one way to bring a message or to bring work to the market.
It's all storytelling, isn't it? No matter, you know, if you're filmmaking or you're script writing or you're writing a poem or even a painting, you know, there are stories behind them all. So I think it's just the art of creation, which is important for people. Now, I do want to ask you a question. You sort of touched on it just before, but I know you write other things as well, but today we're talking about picture books. So why do you write for kids?
I don't know. That's the honest answer. I could try to think of something clever that sounds good to say. I don't have any conscious thought that I didn't at any stage in my career and my life say, you know what, I really want to write for children. I'm destined to write for children. I kind of fell into it, to be honest. I was trying to rediscover and reconnect with my creative self after decades in several businesses that we owned and ran in Canberra, and they were quite successful. So that's the good news. The bad news was the nature of the work, the industry, was just nothing that did much for me. You know, you can try to be creative in how you market and advertise and how you grow a business, but it wasn't really my scene. So I think women tend to morph their needs and their abilities around whatever needs doing at the time. So I did that for decades. You know, I had kids at a late age. We did the juggling to an absurd level with like three businesses on the go at once. Menopause hits and it's like someone ran your head into a brick wall. And then, you know, you're coming out the other side going, you know, the kids are older, or like they're going through puberty when I'm going through menopause, not a good look. So lots of hormones flying in the house. But I thought there's got to be like something more meaningful to me that I would like to do. I want to kind of, I've always been text driven. I've always loved the written word. I've always written throughout my life to make sense of various things. So maybe I'll do that more seriously. And perhaps because the kids were still youngish, you know, you draw from life. So the first book,
yeah, that's true.
Town, that was about kids not wanting to practice music. And our kids were all very musical, one like freakishly musical, but they just hated the lessons. It was like every week this like, and the one was like a brilliant negotiator, so it was almost like we're so impressed.
I love that, like, the musician, the negotiator, you've got it all happening in your house. But
it's like, well, if you pay me cash, what if we do a deal? If I do that, what's
in it? They're so savvy, aren't they? I get the deals too, and I've only got an 11-year-old and I'm still getting the deals. But I love what you said about you draw from your world, because that's exactly what you do. And I think even if you don't know it at the time, I think you always are. You know, I look back on some of the things that I've done and you're like, oh, you know, there's a lot of my life or my world or my thoughts in there. So I think you do always draw from your world. That's really interesting. And I'm so glad that we have had this really deep discussion and we are talking about a picture book, because I am clearly a big fan of picture books. I think they're works of art. I think they can be read on a number of different levels, just for, you know, enjoyment for kids, but then at a deeper level, you know, quite like alphabeta. So I think, you know, they're really important books. And as well as that, you know, they're usually the first books kids pick up, and that can determine whether they become a reader or not, which is a really important job for children's authors, I think. So I really enjoyed listening to you talk about philosophy. It's something I dabbled in uni, because I thought it was, you know, I felt that deep thinking and critical thinking are really important qualities and qualities for our children as well. So I want to thank you for all that information. I'm going to be thinking about that now after the interview.
I dumped a ton on you at late at night. Oh my goodness.
This isn't like late at night for my brain. This is just early.
You're just waking up. Okay. Well,
that's right.
That's showing you our age difference.
No, I just
late and
I'm
or
a,
early.
I'm a late. I'm a late. Late night person, not an early morning. I'd like to sleep in, but with little kids, you don't get to do that either. So,
that's a bit old age. I still don't get to sleep in. So,
one day. Well,
but
thank
you know
you
what?
So much.
But the day you do sleep in, that's probably a bad day, because you don't have those things that are
pressing
you
and needing
you,
and,
engaged, making you want to progress and learn. And every day needs to be like that.
Yeah. And I know you watch your children grow, you know that, you know, they keep growing and they're going to grow out of your house and they're going to grow out of needing you. So that's a whole other challenge as well. That's a whole other podcast, I think.
This is a whole other podcast.
That's a whole other hour.
Tuning in on that one. Thanks so much, Danny, for your time.
Thank you. Ingrid Laguna is a multi-award-winning novelist and educator. Her books include Bailey Finch Takes a Stand, one of my favorites, Sunflower, Songbird, and Kit and Arlo Find a Way. Ingrid, you also have a new writing course, Writing with Ink. Tell me all about this.
Writing with Ink. Ink is actually my nickname. And so what I think will work is small classes. And what I think will work is genuine feedback from myself and from the other people's writing peers during the course. I wanted to share the things that I find to be really critical in writing. And that is that it's really hard to finish. It's really hard to persevere when the going gets tough. But all of these things can be done. And I think that if you know these things are important, and you know that it's normal to have self-doubt, and you know that it's normal that even though your idea might be inspired at the start, you are going to hit a point most likely that it doesn't feel inspired anymore.
Signing up, ingridlaguna.com, and be ready for those courses. Thank you so much, Ingrid, for putting this writing course on for writers.
Thanks so much for having me, Danny B. It's always such a pleasure. I love you.